2007 is a year of several significant anniversaries. Of course, the 60th anniversary of the establishment of the Air Force in September 18th, 1947. It's also the 100th anniversary of the Air Force heritage going back to 1907 with the establishment of the Aeronautical Division of the Army Signal Corps. It's the 60th anniversary of this month of Chuck Yeager's X-1 supersonic flight. It's the 50th anniversary of the first launch of the Atlas ICBM. It's the 25th anniversary of the establishment of Air Force Space Command on 1 September 1982. It's also the 40th anniversary of the first flight of the Saturn V, the moon rocket. That occurred on November 9th, 1967. And, of course, the 50th anniversary of the flight of Sputnik 1 in October 4th, 1957, which brought about the start of the space age and also the start of the space race with the Cold War. Tonight's talk, it will not be about the history of rocketry. We're not going to be talking about strategic missiles. Doug Lantry, one of the museum's historians, spoke to you about that last spring. Rather, it's going to be a brief overview of the Air Force involvement in space, the genesis of the Air Force in the space program, touch briefly upon the various different types of satellites, talk also about some canceled Air Force manned spaceflight programs, the Air Force-NASA partnership, also the partnership with the Air Force with other Department of Defense agencies. And so basically, this is just going to be a very brief overview. In the future, Doug and myself and perhaps other historians in the research division will be coming back to talk about various aspects of the Air Force and space and the space program in much greater detail. Obviously, you're talking about a long time period. A lot of important accomplishments occurred, and some of those accomplishments get kind of complicated, so we only have an hour, so I think that's the best way to approach this. Okay, we're talking about space, and you're probably wondering why are you showing a picture of Pearl Harbor. Well, as you'll find later on, the thing is about Pearl Harbor is it was a surprise attack. And it thrust the United States into a global war. And, of course, it brought about a lot of deaths to American citizens. And you'll see how this Pearl Harbor effect came to kind of be an important element of American thought on how we would deal with the Soviet Union and communism and how to prevent World War III. Now, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the space age because of Sputnik 1. It's probably as good a place as any to start when you're talking about the space age. Of course, during World War II, the V-2, the world's first ballistic missile, brought a new dimension to warfare. So once it was launched, you couldn't stop it. And the problem when you combine the V-2 with rocketry, ICBMs, strategic missiles, and nuclear warfare, that's when you start having some serious problems and changes in how you conduct the next war. The threat of a nuclear holocaust really was in the minds of American policymakers ever since the end of World War II, which brought about nuclear weapons and rocketry. And both of these technologies changed how American leadership would view the space age. These competing ideologies between the Soviet Union, communism, in the United States and the free world and democracy, of course, brought about the Cold War. So a big part of the entire story of the space age, space race, obviously, was the Cold War. Without the Cold War, we wouldn't have the space race as we had, as it occurred. I think everyone knows General Hap Arnold. What a lot of people may not realize is that Hap Arnold was extremely future-minded. He was a very advanced thinker that He didn't live in the past, and although he obviously dealt with the present, he was not afraid to look forward. And as early as November 1945, right after the end of World War II, Arnold wrote that spaceships could be built in the foreseeable future. Now think about it. This is just 1945. The V-2 had come on the stage, but obviously no one had ordered anything yet. And here, Hap Arnold, a military man, the top Air Force official, obviously, is thinking about manned spaceships surfing the Earth. Now, also the Navy in the end of World War II, they saw some possibilities in space, militarily speaking. They went more for, they were trying to get all the services together for an inter-service cooperation program to tackle the problem of space, combine resources, and that way they could have a foot in the door, so to speak. But another general, Curtis LeMay, when he found out about the Navy's efforts to get an inter-service cooperative program going, he got very upset because he saw, from his point of view, the space environment as just being an outgrowth of the air power that the United States Air Force was responsible for. So eventually, as we'll find out, the services kind of went their separate ways until later on when the Air Force was given control of the services space program. Now, Arnold, as I mentioned earlier, was very interested in space, and he asked Theodore von Karman, along with putting together the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, to look at the future technologies the Air Force should explore and look into for to prepare ourselves for the next conflict. And von Karman and his consultants put together a report called Toward New Horizons. Now, in that report, it dealt with the whole spread of various new technologies, from jet power, new materials, electronics, radar, but also touched briefly on rocketry. And in concert with that, there was a RAND study, kind of a think tank at that point, the RAND Corporation was, put together a preliminary design report called the Preliminary Design of an Experimental World Circling Spaceship, and they published that document in May of 1946. And in that document, they pointed out the fact of space being very important and a good potential for observation, reconnaissance, weather observation and forecasting, and communications. Now, obviously, all three of those elements are extremely important in fighting a war or preventing a war. If you know exactly what the enemy is doing, you can maneuver your forces, put your forces together in order to fight the most efficient way possible. And the weather, you can use weather to your advantage instead of a hindrance. Also, General Hoyt Vandenberg in 1948 claimed that the logical responsibility for the satellite regime belonged to the Air Force, pretty much echoing Curtis LeMay. Now, with the General Eisenhower, after the war, obviously, the Soviets began to stretch their boundaries. We had the Berlin airlift in 1948. August of 49, the Soviets detonated their first atomic bomb. June of 1950, North Korea invades South Korea. August of 1953, the Soviets detonate their first hydrogen bomb. So you see that the Cold War is pretty much heating up. Now, because the Soviet Union is a closed society in communism, but basically the Soviet Union's view that pretty much put up an iron curtain, we really didn't know what was going on in that vast Soviet Union realm. So obviously part of the problem with preparing for the next conflict or preventing the next conflict is reconnaissance. And one of the first things we tried to do was Project Mogul, which was balloon sensors to try to pick up nuclear tests, signs of nuclear tests. These Project Mogul, these large balloons, weather balloons, were not very successful because obviously they kind of depend on the high altitude winds. A lot of times when they were recovered, there wasn't anything useful on the film. So obviously that didn't work out too well. So the United States at that point realized that in order to have a better grasp of what the Soviet Union was doing, and to prevent another Pearl Harbor, we really needed to find a way to go behind the Iron Curtain and find out what the Soviet Union was doing. And, of course, that brought about some of the possibilities with high-altitude reconnaissance, the U-2. Of course, you have problems with that, as we found out in May of 1960. But just as to underscore further about the thought process in the United States, there was yet again another study on how to provide security to the United States in February 1955. And this panel, they put together a panel, General Eisenhower did, and it was first known as the Surprise Attack Panel. It was later known as the Technological Capabilities Panel. But they produced a report, and the report's title was Meeting the Threat of Surprise Attack. Again, we go back to Pearl Harbor. Edwin Land wrote a section on high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft to overfly the Soviet Union, which, as I mentioned, became Aquatone, which became the U-2 project. And also, there was some also talk about military satellites and the possibilities provided in that technology. Again, weather, communications, and reconnaissance. RAND's study group also put together another report called The Utility of a Satellite Vehicle for Reconnaissance. And also a later report in 54 called Project Feedback. And essentially what they were thinking of is to orbit a satellite, a reconnaissance satellite. And their first thought was to have this satellite take photographs. It would process the film in the satellite. It would have electronics to scan the processed film. And they would beam that information down. However, that started to become problems with the technology. And so in March of 56, a couple of people decided maybe the best way to do this would be a film recovery system. We're years away from having this film scanning capability. In the meantime, the Soviet Union is detonating hydrogen bombs. They're building up their military forces. We don't know what's going on. We don't want to have a nuclear Pearl Harbor. That would be devastating to the United States. It would be a nuclear holocaust. So when they came across with Eisenhower, they decided, okay, let's go for this stopgap program. But Eisenhower was very concerned about how the rest of the world and the Soviet Union would view this reconnaissance satellite. So the first problem that he concerned himself with was how to go about establishing the freedom of space. Now, FDR had established the freedom of the seas in World War II, but no one yet had really dealt with that concept of space overflights. So President Eisenhower was very concerned about how public opinion and the Soviet Union would react if we just started flying these military reconnaissance satellites around the world. It could be a trigger for armed conflict. So what he decided to do is have a civilian scientific satellite launched first to establish the concept of freedom of space. And the perfect time for that would be during the International Geophysical Year of 1957 to 1958. So his plan was to orbit a civilian satellite during this year with instruments, scientific instruments, for weather forecasting, the ozone layer, what have you. And that would overfly the entire world. And by doing so, that would help establish, under international law, countries' rights to send up satellites that would orbit and overfly all other countries in the world. So that's the aspect that President Eisenhower took. At the same time, however, Eisenhower also started this Air Force program, which came to be known as Corona, for reconnaissance satellite. That was kind of obviously top secret. So essentially what you have is President Eisenhower having an open civilian scientific satellite program for the United States, going along slowly, minimally funded, but going along slowly. And underneath the table, so to speak, you have a military reconnaissance satellite, which Corona, spearheaded by the Air Force, going at the same time. Now, both those programs, unfortunately, were funded at very low levels. So progress was very slow until October 4th, 1957 with Sputnik. And then Sputnik did two things. It established the concept of the freedom of the space for everybody, including the United States, and also opened up the funding gates to all the satellite programs in the United States, both civilian and also the secret Corona program. So, in effect, the Soviet Union did the United States a huge favor by putting up Sputnik. No longer did Eisenhower and American leadership have to be concerned with establishing the concept of the freedom of space. And the people working on the Corona project finally started getting the funding that they so direly needed to get that program moving. In February of 1958, in conjunction with Sputnik, President Eisenhower also ordered the highest national priorities for all ballistic missiles, Atlas, Titan I's, ICBMs, also the intermediate range ballistic missiles, the Thor and the Jupiter, and also the weapon system 117L system, which included the Corona and all other satellite reconnaissance systems. And days after that, the Corona project was approved. Again, the Corona was not necessarily a part of the weapon system 117L, but it was kind of a stopgap measure in conjunction with that program. In Corona, again, the difference between Corona and what was in weapon system 117L was that Corona could be accomplished quicker because basically it just had the unprocessed film ejected in space, re-enter the atmosphere to be recovered. Then we would process the film and obtain the information that way. And then until hopefully in a few years, the more advanced film scanning method would come online. Now, Corona was obviously top secret, but they had, obviously with so much work going on, they had to have a cover name, so they just called it the Discoverer Program, which is supposed to be a scientific program. Discoverer 13, which as we'll see later on, carried just a flag, and that's the symbol for the International Geophysical Year. There were two competing programs for President Eisenhower's civilian scientific program. The Navy had their Vanguard project, and the Army had their Orbiter proposal. Eisenhower wanted, again, this scientific satellite to establish the international law of freedom of the space. But in the meantime, what he decided was the Navy program probably had more possibilities than the Army, so he selected Vanguard over the Army. The Army program was being headed up by Wernher von Braun of V-2 fame. And I think everyone here has probably seen the museum's model of the Sputnik. I always kind of very interesting to me that in so many reports they refer to it as a basketball-sized sphere. It's actually quite a bit larger than that. The first answer to Sputnik from the United States was Vanguard. This is the Navy's program. It had a scientific satellite. And the only problem with Vanguard is that it tended to explode. So after several, this was after the Sputnik. And, of course, the thing about Sputnik, one of the very many aspects of Sputnik was that it established to the world, or the world kind of sensed the technical superiority of the Soviet Union compared to the United States. And it's very symbolic. Although this Sputnik really didn't have that much in the way of scientific instruments on board, it was very symbolic of the advanced engineering of the Soviet Union. Also the possibility of, well, we can do this. We could put a warhead on one of our bigger rockets and do the same thing. And as the satellite would go across American skies, you could look up and see that presence of the Soviet Union. And so then when later, in 57, the United States tried their Vanguard series as a statement of our superiority, and this would happen time and time again, it did not, it was a point of embarrassment to the United States. So I don't want to spend too much time on this because we're trying to talk about the Air Force, but finally Wernher von Braun and the Army was given the go-ahead to get the Explorer 1 to try to have their try at it after the Navy effort failed a couple of times. And end of January, 1958, January 31st to be exact, using a modified Redstone booster, Explorer 1 was successfully placed into orbit. Now that's the full-size example of Explorer 1, and try to remember that because when we get to the more modern satellites, you can see how satellites have grown over the years. This is actually like the fourth stage. That's a rocket motor there. The scientific package is just this area up here, and of course that's Wernher von Braun. The Sputnik. Just to give you an example, Sputnik 1 weighed about 184 pounds. Sputnik 2, which went up about a month later with the dog Laika inside, weighed over 1,000 pounds. And the Vanguard, the Navy's grapefruit-sized satellite, weighed 3.5 pounds. So you can see that there's a little bit of a capability gap there, which is not lost in the Soviet Union and their PA folks. So in the face of public opinion, although at the time President Eisenhower tried not to panic, so to speak, with the Soviet Union's successes, under pressure, political pressure and public opinion, he decided he really had to revamp the entire space program in the United States. And so NASA was established in 1958. Now, that was the civilian side. Now, back to the military side. A project office was established here at Wright-Patt for reconnaissance satellites. And also at the end of 1954, General Bernard Schriever had been assigned to oversee the development of the ICBM, which is separate initially from satellites, because instead of a satellite, you're talking with a warhead. But the development of the ICBM gave the United States the boosters it needed to put satellites, both civilian and military, up into space. Later on in March of 1961, the administration decided to make the Air Force the designated lead military service for all space activities. And there's General Schriever right there. We have an awful lot to thank for General Schriever. He really, Doug Lantry spoke to you a few months ago, he really got the American ICBM program off the ground. And his efforts and his foresight was really beneficial to the United States, both in militarily space terms and also in civilian space terms. And this is a photograph of, shows the Discover 13 on here. Discover 13 was launched on top of a Thor Agena rocket, and we have a reproduction, so to speak, in the Hall of Missiles. Of course, the Thor was an international IRBM, and on top of it was the Agena upper stage. And the Agena upper stage was designed specifically to help get classified payloads into orbit. And then, of course, at the very top, that's the Discover satellite. And this is what's this is a later model of the Discover / Corona. You can see here you've got the film cartridges in this take-up cassettes. This one actually has two reentry vehicles. That one there and there. And after the cameras, those are the cameras right there. The cameras would take the pictures, and they would be taken up in these cassettes, and then they would be they would re-enter the atmosphere. That's another illustration of the take-up spools. And after they re-entered the atmosphere, they were retrieved in midair by Air Force C-119Js. And, of course, our C-119 was the C-119 that retrieved Discover 14. Which was the very first reconnaissance satellite to bring back reconnaissance images. This is a picture of President Eisenhower looking at, this is Discover 13. They just brought back an American flag. But this is the world's first photograph taken from space. It shows an airfield in the Soviet Union. It was launched, Discover 14 was launched August 19th, 1960. So it was Discover 14, you can do the math. We had several failures, and we're still in between the very first one and the later one. Also, a lot of the earlier ones were development missiles as well. Now, after the establishment of the Freedom of Space and Discover's program started to build up, we decided to develop other types of satellites. This is a Vela satellite. It's a nuclear detection satellite. And these were launched on top of Titan IIIs. You can see they're starting to get more complicated and larger. And also the MIDAS, the missile detection and alarm system. This is on the Atlas Agena. Again, the Atlas is the ICBM. Defense Meteorological Satellite Program. I mentioned before that weather is a very important part of fighting and waging a war. And the DMSP satellites are doing their work up there. This is a DSCS, Defense Satellite Communication System. It's obviously to help communications. And again, they are getting larger and larger. Everyone's heard of GPS. And a lot of times, a lot of people nowadays have civilian GPS units. Global positioning system, navigation. You need a constellation, so to speak, of 24 of these GPS satellites to be fully operational. And they reached that number, that magic number of 24, in July of 1995. 24-hour navigation system anywhere in the world put up with a Delta II rocket. MILSTAR, Joint Service Communication System, links all the services with communication. This photograph does not show the solar panel, but we'll get to a diagram next slide. These, obviously, they're getting larger and larger, and the larger the payload, the heavier the payload, the larger booster you need. And these use Titan IVs to get up in space. And this is a diagram of one of the MILSTARs. You can see that photograph before was just showed this aspect of it. And then, of course, the solar panels, 120-foot span. They can't support their own weight on Earth, however. Now, this is a Milstar satellite on its Titan IV shroud, to give you an idea. And there's two technicians standing next to it. You can see that they've gotten much, much larger from the days of Explorer 1. The DSP satellite, known as its early warning system, it detects rocket exhaust and it gives the United States warnings of whenever a large rocket has been launched. These were also used to good effect in Desert Storm for notifying the United States and its partners about Scud launches. This is Atlas Agena. This is a good point to bring up, that the Air Force is pretty much responsible for boosters for not only Air Force satellites, but also NRO, National Reconnaissance Office satellites, CIA, other military services, as well as NASA. So we pretty much take the lead, and we have the responsibility and authority concerning that. This is Atlas Centaur with a high-energy Centaur upper stage for larger and heavier payloads. Atlas Agena D. Speaking of NASA, and I believe this is a shot of one of those NASA flights. I don't know if this is Ranger or Mariner. But, again, NASA, this is a partnership that NASA has with the Air Force. Not only do we supply the launchers, but in many cases we're responsible for the setup and launch. And this is a relatively recent Delta II launch for a GPS satellite. And you notice at the bottom we have some solid strap-on rocket motors for extra thrust. And I like the shark mouth on the payload bay. And this is the Titan IIIC that was used for very heavy satellites. And here you see the extremely large solid rocket motors, which if you've noticed any shuttle flights, they have a couple of solid rocket boosters on those as well. Titan IVs, these have been, they are no longer being used. In fact, the museum has the very last one still in existence, and that's planned to go into the future space hangar that the museum is currently planning. And this will give you an idea on, it has different shroud sizes depending on the payload. Ours, the museum's, has the long shroud. So when it's, it will be displayed horizontally because obviously of the height. It, even horizontally at a slight angle, it should be very, very impressive to look at. And there she is on takeoff, liftoff. Air Force satellites were used in Southeast Asia for weather, communications. And space systems and satellites, military satellites, have become crucial in modern warfare. During the Gulf War, many people refer to the Gulf War as the first space war because 90% of the communications, military communications, were via satellite. DSP satellites, as I mentioned, were very helpful in tracking down Scuds and warning of Scud launches. GPS, weather, targeting, navigation, satellite-guided weapons. The United States and her coalition forces enjoyed an information domination during that war, mainly due to space systems, satellites. And it has become, military space operations have now become as important to military operations as normal air, ground, or sea power. Well, once again, the United States found itself behind in the space race because of Yuri Gagarin's flight in April 12, 1961. After this flight, President Kennedy established a National Space Program to try to get the United States back up to speed and try not to lose further to the Soviet Union. This is the Vostok. Now, the big part of this is Project Mercury, and we're going to start talking about the manned spaceflight program. Now, obviously, the manned spaceflight program in the United States is essentially civilian, run by NASA. However, all the military services, including the Air Force, have been heavily involved since day one. Training facilities, astronauts, obviously, launch personnel. And it started with Project Mercury. And, of course, in Project Mercury, we have three Air Force astronauts, Gordon Cooper, Gus Grissom, and Deke Slayton. Deke had some medical problems, so he didn't fly in the Mercury program, but the other two did. And Cooper's flight was the very last Mercury flight. It was the longest. It was over a day. And since that time, over 80 Air Force astronauts have flown in NASA missions. So we're a good supplier of high-quality astronauts. It's the Mercury Redstone. This is actually one of the pre-manned flights. This is the Army Redstone booster with the Mercury spacecraft on top. The problem with this, the first two Mercury missions were suborbital because these wanted to try out some of the technology first. The Redstone just didn't have the power to get the Mercury spacecraft into orbit. So they had to rely on the United States Air Force to supply the booster, an Atlas D booster, and all the orbital Mercury flights were flown with Air Force Atlas boosters. And this is actually John Glenn's flight going off. In the two-man Gemini series, which I think most people are pretty well aware of, from the very beginning, heavier spacecraft, two men obviously, they had to rely on modified Titan II ICBMs for boosters. And this is a shot of astronaut Ed White, the first U.S. spacewalker, another Air Force astronaut. And, of course, Apollo program. We provided training, research facilities, launch crews, astronauts, and obviously you could say we won the space race with Apollo 11. Just a brief overview of some of the more possibly well-known Air Force astronauts. In the middle there is General Tom Stafford. He also flew in Gemini 9 in the Apollo Soyuz, good friend of the museum. And here's a shot of Buzz Aldrin on the moon, Apollo 11, Air Force, again. You can see in his reflection in his visor, Neil Armstrong. So there is a picture of Neil Armstrong on the moon. Apollo 15, and this is the spacecraft that we have here at the museum on loan from the Smithsonian, all Air Force crew. Of course, you got Scott Warden and Irwin. Also, there was Major General William Anders, Apollo flight, Brigadier General Susan Helms, Air Force shuttle flights, and Charlie Duke, Air Force serviceman who also placed an Air Force medallion on the surface of the moon. So there you can give you an idea of both Mercury and Gemini. The programs were essentially flown with Air Force boosters, and with a lot of help from the Air Force, the Apollo missions were a great success. In the late 50s, however, just to backtrack, the Air Force was interested also in getting some Air Force-specific programs off the ground. And one of those became known as a Dinosaur, kind of a manned hypersonic Mach 5-plus space vehicle. And they had a lot of different space programs envisioned, but the Dinosaur for dynamic soaring was essentially a one-man space shuttle. The problem with this, and what the Air Force wanted to do, is use this to kind of explore the ability of military men in space, reconnaissance. They also were looking for a potential rocket bomber, the Robo, and also for possibly a space interceptor. But then politics kind of enters into it. President Kennedy's administration later on, as the project grew, they didn't want to extend the arms race into space. It's one thing to have satellites circling the globe, taking photographs, measuring electronic signals, but it's another to have actual weapons on board, and they didn't want to cross that, the administration didn't want to cross that boundary. And also, once you started weaponizing and having manned weapons, interceptors up in space, Kennedy was very concerned that the Soviet Union would in turn start attacking our reconnaissance satellites, because that's, again, from a closed society, that was the only way we could really get some sort of feeling what was going on behind the Iron Curtain. He did not want to threaten a good thing with something which may have destabilized the space environment. So actually, later in 1963, the Dinosaur, which was canceled, between the time it was called the Dinosaur to the time it was canceled, they changed the name to the X-20 to reflect the fact that the Air Force said, okay, maybe we'll just make an experimental program. Instead of operational space interceptor or rocket bomber, we'll just have an experimental program. So they thought that the administration would find that easier to swallow. But it faced political and technical problems. Boeing was the prime contractor. That's kind of an illustration of the interior. And they built a lot of studies, full-size mock-up. At first, they wanted to put it on a Titan booster, but then, like tends to happen with aerospace programs, the X-20 gained weight. And in order to compensate, they had to have a more powerful booster, so they have a Titan 3C in this illustration. And once it got into orbit, second stage would come off, and then the third stage would help it get into orbit. The idea, again, the Air Force's view is once you put a man up there, they could do a better job with reconnaissance, interception, satellites, what have you, weather, reconnaissance. But like I said, it was canceled in December 63 for basically political and budgetary reasons. And like the tile system used on the shuttle, they had pretty much like a heat sink type of construction. And we might do it's kind of an interesting vehicle, interesting concept. We might do a VIP just on the X-20 because there's some interesting footage available on that interesting vehicle. After the X-20 was canceled, it was pretty much replaced by a program called the Manned Orbiting Laboratory, or MOL. The earliest Air Force feasibility studies of a military space station goes back to 1960. And they wanted to determine the military usefulness of a man in space long term, not just like the X-20 was basically up maybe for a few orbits and returned to Earth. But they wanted to find out what would happen if you had a crew up there for a month or so. Although the MOL program itself was not designed to keep a permanent space station up there, they wanted to experiment with reconnaissance and other types of space activities, and just to see how well the manned space station would work out for military purposes. Now, this is a Gemini B, or Blue Gemini, spacecraft. And actually, the Gemini spacecraft that we have here at the museum is a Gemini B. It has a different adapter back there because, let's go to the next slide here. there's the circular hatch right there to one side of the heat shield. Now, this is attached to the heat shield. You have one of the adapters here, so you can't see the heat shield alone. But if you go back to the hull of missiles, if you look closely at our Gemini B, you'll see that circular area in the heat shield. And these are the retro rockets when it would fire to return back to Earth. And the concept was to have the Gemini, which was being developed by NASA, attached to essentially the upper stage of a Titan, and this would be a space station. You have the Gemini reentry vehicle here. You have the main cabin, auxiliary cabin, experiment module, equipment module, and the trans stage. But again, it was supposed to be up for 30 days in space with the crew. But it had technical problems, weight problems, that ugly weight problem, and budget problems, kind of a common occurrence. Although in this case, the budget may actually have been the main reason for its cancellation, although there's another one. Well, I'll show you a brief clip at the end, which may have been even a bigger element to it. But the cost of the program went from $1.5 billion when it first began to $3 billion in 1969. So at that point, they decided it really wasn't worth it. They actually went as far as to select three different groups of mall crews. And this is a picture of one crewman. And they actually also put together not a complete laboratory configuration, but it was the same weight and length with the Gemini B boilerplate spacecraft at the top. And they launched it on top of Titan 3C. They also came under criticism because, in addition to rising costs, there was no well-defined mission. And even more importantly, again, by 1969, unmanned satellites could do the job pretty much just as well and a lot cheaper. Another aspect of the Air Force's involvement in manned space flight, of course, the X-15. And the X-24B. X-24B was very important in helping to develop and configure the space shuttle, the process, the landing configuration for the space shuttle. And obviously, the museum has the X-24B here. And we come to the space shuttle. The Air Force was involved in some of the preliminary design work of the space shuttle. The payload bay, for one, is the length of it, at least, was pretty much an Air Force requirement. The first DOD military shuttle mission was in January 24th, 1985. There have been several since, until 1992, when the final military flight occurred. With the loss of Challenger, the military services and DOD agencies had put pretty much all their eggs in one basket with the shuttle. With the loss of Challenger and the probability of another disaster coming, and when the Challenger was lost, it pretty much stopped temporarily all shuttle flights. That was not good for the military's side, because they needed to constantly replenish and put up more advanced satellites. So they had these satellites and no way to get them up in space, and they realized they could not protect the country and have this situation occur again. So with the Challenger incident, heavy lift Titan 4s were ordered, and also medium lift Delta 2s were ordered to prevent us from being caught empty-handed again. Some well-known Air Force astronauts, General Kevin Chilton. He flew on three shuttle flights. He's now the head, the four-star, he's now head of U.S. Strategic Command off at Air Force Base, Nebraska. Also, we have Air Force Colonel Eileen Collins, the first woman shuttle commander. She recently retired from NASA. And the retired Air Force Colonel Pamela Milroy, who's up there right now as we speak on a current shuttle mission. So I think you can see that the Air Force involvement in space through the Air Force Space Command is defending America through control and exploitation of space. The Air Force requires launch and sustained space systems, not only for the United States Air Force, but also for DOD agencies and NASA.